You're listening to the Scottish Football Marketing Podcast. On this show, Chris Sampson and I, Michael Bockle, were joined by Daryl Broadfoot to discuss PR, content and handling a crisis. As you'll find out, Daryl has a varied background and has been actively involved in Scottish football for quite a while. With his background in journalism and now in PR, he takes us through his thoughts on the current state of play in Scottish football. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Scottish Football Marketing Podcast with Michael Bockle from the Scottish FA. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
And I'm Chris Sampson from Sports Marketing Scotland. We're covering a few topics on this episode. It'll mainly be around PR, with a bit of a focus on how to approach some comms in a perceived crisis as well, because it's Scottish football. We've got Daryl Broadfoot on to give us his expert opinion on the matter. Hello, Daryl.
Hello, I didn't think you scripted this. I thought it was all ad-libbed.
I just script this bit and then I come
good,
in later
good.
On.
Good to be here.
Before we talk to Daryl, Michael, why did we want to talk about this specific topic?
I think we've done a little bit of PR and media with a couple of previous guests, but Daryl being who he is with his experience, having been a journalist and giving away everything that he's probably going to say, but also I've worked alongside Daryl here, now he's gone into agency world, he has seen it from many different sides now, so hopefully as we go through this he'll be able to take his opinion from how it looks on different sides as well.
Yeah. It's a polite way of saying I'm here because I've got more faces than Big Ben.
Michael just gave us a bit of a spoiler, but Daryl, take us through a bit about your background and what are you up to right now?
God, don't even see my Twitter page. Don't ask about my background. Started off making tea and coffee. I loved watching the papers because it brought a bit of nostalgia back. Started off in the Herald editorial as a 16-year-old who didn't get called his name for the first year. Just got called boy and was then supposed to remember whose voice it was and whether they wanted tea or coffee, toast and jam or toast and cheese. So after that, became a sports writer, became chief football writer of the Herald, and after 2 and a bit years routinely criticising the Scottish FA, one day they said, well, if you're that smart, why don't you come in? Said I would stay for 3 years, ended up staying for 6, and was effectively frog marched out the building because I was starting to annoy people, and started up as head of sport at Frame.
What is Frame, just for anybody that doesn't know?
Frame was a traditional advertising agency of kind of 30 years standing. Now it's a fully integrated creative agency, specialising in creative design, marketing, web building, app development, PR, strategic communications, media buying, so everything that a modern company needs from an agency, and more importantly, and we'll touch on this later, integrated in one building.
You mentioned you work in a couple of sports clients already. Is there any that you can mention?
I can mention them all.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'll love it.
Go for it.
Okay, so fortunately, the first bid we pitched for was with UEFA, and it was UEFA's We Play Strong women's campaign, and we went out to Neon, Stephen, who's now the joint MD of the wider agency, went out to Neon to pitch for the We Play Strong PR contract. Spent €23 and 2 gin and tonics, and mercifully, having come up against some pretty big hitting London agencies, emerged victorious. And I maintain what you learn in here, what you learn in the environment of Scottish football, the journalistic traits that I still have, enable you in the kind of agency environment to get to the solution. Not that, listen, you hear in agency life the pitch theatre, which is great, and I think ultimately, especially in sport and in football, you need to have your creds, you need to understand the terrain, you need to know your subject matter. My world has always been about practical solutions. Scottish football's not awash with market and investment, so you have to be resilient, you have to work on a budget, you have to know how to get to a solution quickly, and I think that helps in agency life. You allowed to swear on this programme?
Yeah.
Because I think more and more people can smell the bullshit. And I've always prided myself on sometimes maybe over-egging it, but just trying to be pragmatic, trying to be practical and not bullshitting people. So I think that serves you well domestically, And what is Frame? I said before, Frame was a kind of advertising agency, a Glasgow-based advertising agency. In my mind, it's a creative content and creative agency based in Glasgow. There's a subtle but significant difference. World's a smaller place now, and businesses, regardless of size and scale, want a quick solution, want an integrated solution, and that's what I think we are offering, and certainly that's what we're conscious of offering.
Yeah. You mentioned Scottish football and
hashtag ad.
we'll put that in the show notes. You mentioned Scottish football. Take us through your thoughts on it, where the game is now from a PR and kind of marketing perspective. Where do we start?
You could get a 5-episode series alone on that question. Where is it at? Scottish football to me always punches above its weight, and I've heard you on a regular basis make the same point and bring in the same guests who all, almost unanimously, work way beyond their means. If you want to succeed in Scottish football, you have to go the extra mile. Ailsa is working beyond. Why does the producer not get a speaking part?
She doesn't want one.
Doesn't want it. Okay. But the point of me is, you're doing this at the end of your working day. And everybody goes the extra mile in Scottish football because it doesn't have the great marketing budget that other brands, other companies, other sports benefit from. So I think Scottish football sometimes hides its light under a bushel. I think we're now starting to see a change in trend where traditionally it was the accountant or the lawyer who took charge and was the chief exec. Now, creative types, Alan Burrows at Motherwell is the stereotypical answer to the point where he's probably a blazer now, he's been in the job that long. But you know the point I'm making, people now understand the value of growing your brand, whereas before, any mention of brand, you were kind of looked at as if you had two heads. So we're on a journey. It would be great if we had more money to fuel that journey, but Scottish football is in a good place. It can be in a much better place with a bit more of a concerted effort, but we should all be grateful for the work that a younger generation of people are bringing to big traditional old clubs. The tanker turns slowly, but I think there's now enough might behind that wheel and kind of youthful enthusiasm to steer it quicker to where it needs to be.
Talking of tradition, is traditional PR, would you say, is it dead? Is that a bold claim? I know I came from an SEO background, and every second week somebody was trying to claim that SEO was dead, so...
In the same way that people say traditional journalism's dead, or traditional comms, or traditional marketing, the principles remain as important as ever. You look at, for example, Brexit debate, you look at Donald Trump's presidency. You may not like it, but it's propped up by a form of PR. What we're talking about is the kind of channel changing. The principles remain the same. People are consuming it in a different way. I get annoyed, and the paper probably added to that in a way, but people saying newspapers are dead. Well, the term newspaper might be dead in 5 years' time, but the consumption of news has never been more important, has never been more widely read or widely fixated on. It's the first thing I do when I get up in the morning. Never used to be the case. Yeah. I used to drive or get the bus into work and be schooled on, you must read the paper first. Now, within 5 minutes of getting up in the morning, you read the news. You just read it on your phone. And people who say that sound as if they're one step behind, and I'm conscious at 40 that I sound like an old man already. Because to a new generation of people, to my 4-year-old daughter, who can go on an iPad and go on to YouTube Kids, that's just how people exist these days. Like the phrase digital, and we'll maybe touch on that later as well. People still talk about digital departments, we have to go digital. The world is digital, and if you're not talking that way, you're gone. So traditional PR as we knew it, we'll get you X coverage and X publication, and we'll do a nice big AVE that shows you what you would have done if you'd have paid for advertising. Gone. Content, cliche time, is king or queen. And so people who understand what content is and how that content can be consumed will win, and that's what will make it thrive. Looking at it from a nostalgic perspective is one route to, whether it's a business, a sport, a football club, one sure way of killing it.
I've come from a business background and into football, and one of the things that I think always I noticed pretty quickly was when you work in business, there's clear.
You were a marketeer, what was your business?
But right, especially because I worked in agencies as well, and clients always had clear objectives of what they were looking to do. Football, to me, I don't know, sometimes there's a lot of go out there, and apart from sell tickets, there doesn't seem to be any clear objectives. What are the sort of things clients are coming to you to try and achieve nowadays?
Conversion of data. What does that mean? Well, success and return on their investment. Gone are the days of, I mean, even if you look at external advertising, and I had a look at the drum last week. Social advertising is now overtaking print advertising for the first time globally. Advertising, what, 44% of it is now on the internet. So that's what any client, any consumer wants from its customers or its brand. We will pay X, but we want to see this. And social advertising, social content, content that's online focused will give you that return. You don't need to have a stab at the dark and hope for the best. You can actually see the results. Influencer marketing is something that we'll come on to, but that's why people are now more inclined to have those partnerships, because they understand that X times Y equals Z. You can measure it in a way that you couldn't have before, and that's terrific. That's terrific if you're in charge of a marketing budget, if you're in charge of a communications budget. You can be more demanding, you can be more specific in what you need. So whether it's a small local charity or whether it's a huge kind of global business, they all want the same thing: return, value for money, and the feeling that by taking your service, their organisation is better off. It's simple, and football, as you touched on, sometimes has a more traditional outlook, and more that's becoming apparent that the new generation of people actually get it, understand it, can work on a relative shoestring, and the results bear out that maybe we should invest a bit more. The sooner we get to maybe we should invest a bigger percentage every year, then we get to where we need to be quicker.
You mentioned earlier about kind of underinvestment in the game in Scotland, and then you talked a lot there about investment and having to pay for quite a lot of advertising these days. Football clubs, we know, come from quite a privileged position in that they have a big, huge fan base already that they can easily kind of engage with. What would you say in terms of, if they came to you, would you recommend that they need to spend money, or would you recommend that they just need to spend it a little bit
by investment? It doesn't necessarily just mean pounds, shilling and pence.
Yeah.
But we're still in a situation where somebody will probably more rather bring, and maybe a smaller club would see greater benefit in having a printer in its office than a social media content creator. Well, I'm sorry, but you get a social media content creator out of university, he or she will deliver a far greater return than the printer that's actually harming the rainforest. So without being hokey about it, the investment doesn't have to be in huge sums of money, but a £50 ad spend for a League Two club to drive a bit of targeted ticket sales to people who maybe not read the newspaper,
yeah,
but exist online, try it out. If it fails, it's £50, but if it works, then what if we did 100? And it's just that mindset. I have every sympathy for clubs who live hand to mouth, who've got bills to pay, and small enough in its local community to just preserve. But that preservation, and you're seeing the same thing across all sports. Golf at the moment has a big challenge in that every year the membership numbers come out and they go, members are dying off, Scottish golf's got a crisis because not enough members. Actually, there are more and more people playing golf than ever before. It's just how they consume it. So, privileged to be part of that conversation where understanding the flexibility of membership. Membership to a 55-year-old grey-haired man is different to a membership for a 16-year-old who happens to like golf but can't devote 24 rounds every year to make that core membership viable. But it's offering up solutions to all of your audiences, and rather than focusing all your money on your existing customer base, look around, because if you keep fixating on the same customers, there's only two certainties in life, and we'll not talk about taxes in this show, please.
You've mentioned it a couple of times there, content. What, in your opinion, because you're creating a lot of content for your clients as well, what makes good content?
Simple ideas win best. Authentic content. I think sometimes people try and contrive content just because, and I've actually been in those meetings and heard people say, we just want something to go viral. Well, tough. If that's how we're starting the conversation, we ain't going to get very far. Content that resonates to your key audience. I know this sounds simple to marketers, but I think sometimes people just look for a catch-all solution to everybody. So, are you wanting to talk to a teenager? Are you wanting to talk to over 65s because you've got concession prices? Whatever is relevant to that audience. You look at Liverpool, for example. I look from afar, and I'm proud as anything to see Scotland captain starring a Champions League winning team. But also, I love the fact Jurgen Klopp loves 80s rock. And rather than hide and be all corporate, actually, I think more and more non-Liverpool fans love Liverpool because here's a young guy who's actually worked his backside off at Liverpool to get to where he is. But more importantly, there's a rock star manager in all that that entails. Huge personality, and rather than suppress it and make him a robot, actually, I think that's part of Liverpool's mystique, not just on the pitch, but they've tapped into that off the pitch as well.
Even
getting fans there.
James Milner, is it?
Yeah, the personalities. There's no longer a dividing line between fans and players. So, shouldn't be a dividing line within organisations either. They're all trying to achieve the same thing, but amplifying those personalities is the best way to get a positive outcome.
What about then, like we talk about and we try and name the podcast at clubs of all levels, what should clubs be trying to do more of? Give us a flavour.
Well, decision making tends to come from board down. So the sooner we all realise that the geeks shall inherit the earth, the better. And we shouldn't be hiding behind the fact that, it's my default, so I apologise for it, but Uber, biggest taxi company in the world, doesn't own a single taxi. It's a tech platform. Airbnb, doesn't own a single hotel, biggest hotelier in the world. It's a tech app. Accepting that in Dundee, we have one of the most vibrant software and tech cities in the UK, probably Europe, maybe the world if you take Silicon Valley out of the way. Let's tap into it. It's the national sport. So don't think that because you don't know anything about it, you're scared of it and so it becomes a threat. The first day I went into agency world at 38 years of age and looked around me having been one of the young guys in the Scottish FA to realising that I'm now the old guy in the agency, accept it, embrace it, use your experience, but use it to change pace, to change your outlook, but to stick with the principles that have served you well and not to be afraid of hiring people who are more talented than you. So above all, hire people who are more talented, hire people who have got greater enthusiasm, hire people who can make a difference and don't be scared by it.
I'm going to touch on something then, and embracing something that, well, we saw it recently when they probably went about it the wrong way, but Man City were out looking for, or their agency should have correct, it was their agency were out looking for influencers to do some work for them. In your opinion, we're living in a period of influencer marketing, you've already mentioned it earlier on. Is there a place in Scottish football, and if so, what is the role it can play?
Well, yes, for a number of reasons. Again, I talk about embracing the fact that you have limitations, working with younger people who tap into the zeitgeist. First weekend, one of my colleagues, Amy Brownlee, talked about sport and social media, etc., and she had a fixation with Jamie Genevieve. Had not a clue who she was talking about. Fast forward a couple of years, she's now arguably one of the biggest and most successful celebrities in Scotland. How many people who watch telly will know her? Well, maybe those who go on the BBC channel, but somebody who not only, I mean, you walk the streets, you walk shopping centres, and you know the people who have been inspired by Jamie Genevieve. So, if you're a brand, you go to Jamie Genevieve because you understand that millions of people, 1.3 million people, follow her. I had the delight of working with Lewis Capaldi on the Women's World Cup. What's the relevance, you might say? Well, somebody who is a passionate Scotland fan, somebody who actually wanted to help, who was, I think, Norway's part of his European tour, and the ability to track the sentiment for somebody to speak authentically about his experience of watching the Women's World Cup for the first time, incredible. The reach, the engagement, everything was, and the fact he bought into it, short of putting on what he, or let's politely say, was an ill-fitting women's kit. But it was terrific, and those partnerships are the most authentic thing. So you can go social media influencer. I actually don't like the phrase influencer, so I get why people go, oh, it's horrendous. But if you're looking at partnerships, those traditional partnerships, brand A plus club Y equals wallpaper, it's gone. Gone on both sides, because you can't actually utilise that partnership to an audience you want to cultivate. And equally, the brands now realise, well, we've spent X and we don't know what the return is, so actually let's look at other ways of demonstrating that value. And that's why women's football's probably got the best potential for growth in Scotland, certainly UK, and fortunately we've seen it up close in European terms, because it's a blank canvas. Blank canvas with only a modicum of the politics. Still politics, but a different kind of politics. So what you can do is, as a brand, you can actually start to help grow this sport that, through it, in Scotland terms, qualifying for the Women's World, has given a real launch pad. Now there are conversations around what's the optimum kind of domestic model. Great. Rather than the traditional, let's have Administrator X and Administrator Y in the conversation, why not have marketeers, why not have sponsors and partners who've actually taken it to its current position and worked together to create something special. So that's where the influencer marketing, or a more personalised approach to partnerships, is inevitable. Ironically, you take Jimmy Genevieve and Lewis Capaldi out of the equation, I think Scotland as a country has a bit of a journey to grow celebrity, to grow influencers, especially in football. Yeah. And nobody would have thought Simon Ferry would be the person or the personality that he is, probably other than him, because he was always a cocky little so-and-so as a player when he was at Celtic. But it's terrific, and it's reinventing yourself and providing something that the market needs. There's a gap for it. Yeah. The traditional TV model is something that's been disrupted. Sorry, second cliche, disruption, won't use that again. But I think there's more and more scope for people to fill that void, not just in football, but across sport in Scotland.
If we're talking about influences in inverted commas, because yeah, we don't like that term, clubs have players, like a team full of players. Why do they not use them in a way a little bit more?
They do. And some players actually have the wherewithal to understand it themselves. I just put down an example, because in case we were talking about things that inspire us, and fortunate to look at a lot of things that happen around sport. And Toronto Raptors, itty bitty ballers, aware of it? Magnificent. One of their centres, Lithuanian centre Jonas Valančiūnas, decided one day that he wanted to do something different. GoDaddy were looking for a partnership as well to promote their kind of websites, and they partnered up and effectively contrived this modelling. So big NBA player who actually in his spare time crafts models, and he's a big Raptor fan. What they did was created a spoof marketing plan, but actually created those little itty bitty Raptors anyway and sold them for charity. GoDaddy had the biggest exposure they've ever had for their websites, because selling a website can be a bit dull. You've seen some of them on TV. They worked with one of the biggest names in the sport, and he has now gotten a huge amount of traffic and a huge amount of following because of the charitable element. So that's a little example of brand, club getting the halo effect, player out of nowhere deciding, I want to do something a bit left field, and charitable element. So that shows that you don't need to be the chief executive of a club to say we're doing this. Actually, partnerships can come in many ways, and that's one that probably of all of them was the most original, and everybody apart from everybody in this room remembers it.
I know they did try to do something similar in the UK, because they used Harry Redknapp for his Roly Polies, and he created a website, and there was a charitable
one. It's a bit contrived though, Roly Polies, because he ate jam Roly Poly. Yeah. That when you get past that initial, this is a great idea, suddenly it becomes, let's do it again.
Yeah, and that's what they've got. That's where they ended up with Harry Redknapp. But I suppose back to your point, Chris, on, I think you're looking for, why don't players go on social media and push
tickets? Because they're told not to. But more and more, players, especially in England, have their own social media managers, which is great if it's done, and it's like the same thing. I see it from a different side. There was this grand notion of wanting to look after players, not in a selfish agent way, but actually look after players, because sometimes you see clubs who just want to keep 23 people happy, but don't. The personalisation, again, we talk about personalisation in marketing. Personalisation of a dressing room. 23 different personalities, Some will have mental health issues. Some will be uber confident. Some will be gay. Some won't. You're dealing with 23 different personalities, and it's your job now as a modern coach. I go back to Klopp, the best I can see, because he understands that each player is an individual. So understanding that and actually working to unlock the best of those players will get you a better return. Image rights can sometimes be transactional. I sign Cristiano Ronaldo, A, because he's one of the best players in the world, but B, look at his social media following, and whatever I do, I'm going to make money on it. Paul Pogba at Man United, another example. In Scotland, we've got players with personality. We've got Super John McGinn lighting up the English Premier League every other week. So we have personalities that can stand on their own two feet, have to conform to the club ethos, but to answer the question, why do they do it? I think sometimes the club's policies and procedures, bad experiences on Twitter, and a bit of Calvinism. We're still a bit shy in Scotland. Andy Robertson's now a Champions League winner, but he wouldn't be the type to go, I tell you what, I'm going to get a Cristiano Ronaldo style hairstyle or a tattoo. So there's a journey of finding, I think, in Scottish sport, finding our voice, but the more clubs understand, the more players understand their own value, the better for everyone. It gets them closer to the fan as well.
Yeah.
Removing that barrier again.
You've done a lot with players and kind of in content as well. Like, do you come at it from that angle of trying to use them to promote Scottish FA, Scottish national team matches?
Yeah, I mean, for the Scotland national team,
you've absolutely rinsed Andy Robertson, haven't you?
Oh, there's certain players with personality that you keep using, and every club that is listening to this will know the players that they go to as their default. Yeah. And
Tommy said it on the last podcast as well. Exactly.
Yeah. For us, it was at a time, and it still probably is, back to that time of bringing the players closer to the fans, where at international level it's drifted, their fans are a lot closer at club level. So for us, it was about sort of building that bond. You see it more with the women's game, where they'll happily go on and push ticket messaging and look to, and
interestingly, because of the recent professionalisation of the women's game, women's players that we've encountered, either full-time professionals or players who are part-time, because of the lack of financial investment, until the last couple of years, realised they were the most important marketeers. They were players, but they were marketeers of a brand. Yeah. A brand that, bluntly, few people wanted to touch because they weren't convinced on return. And now look what happens. Visa come on board, Nike come on board, SSE domestically come on board, and suddenly you're creating something. And it wouldn't have happened without a lot of, and pioneers in their own way, stepping forward saying, I'm going to be a vlogger. We took that chance with UEFA's We Play Strong. 5 vloggers, professional footballers, give us an insight into your life to make it accessible, to understand that it's cool to be a women's footballer, but more importantly, to inspire people not just to go, I'm going to play football, but that kind of pre-contemplation. Yeah, this is different.
And you've seen it. There is examples out there in the men's game, but not to the extent of what's going on in the women's game from what I can see. But, and this is something we've tried to do with some of the youth players at this level, is do some social media with them, and it's not a lesson of you cannot do this, do not post that, don't post this. It's about building your own brand, if you like, online, but understanding that. And it's a prime example I've said to an under 16 level and under 17 level, and give examples. Andy Robertson's got a public facing Instagram account, but he's got a private one that is for friends and families. Nobody wants to see players, well, some people do, but players shouldn't be posting that from Ocean Beach in Ibiza or go at parties after
losing
a big game.
Especially if Rebecca Vardy follows them.
Posting that they're at a party after a big
game. Producer sniggering, did we capture that?
And then they can do that to their friends and family and then build that brand. And I always say to them, you build your own brand. There's selfish reasons in it as well for a player. They'll get a lot of free stuff, but they'll also help the club. But I think the men's game, personally, is a little bit.
And the great thing is, involved. That. You said you will get free stuff. I think in the early days, that was always the, and you could see it a mile off. Put this on your Instagram account, and we'll give you free. And it just looked rubbish. Now it's evolved. People understand, actually, this is as much value as me doing the normal media rounds. But I can speak to these fans unfiltered. I cannot be misquoted on my own Instagram account, again, notwithstanding the aforementioned Rebecca Vardy.
You work with some other sports. Any lessons you think football can learn from them?
It's funny. The more sports I get involved in, And Boxing Scotland's the most recent one. I've been fortunate enough to join the board of Boxing. The challenges are all the same. Grow the game, get it better at elite level, make sure there's a pathway in place, but in all of it, the one thing that's missing, and I think that's just the way sports governing bodies are set up, not enough focus on marketing budget. And I mean not just from a marketing department, but comms, marketing, a commercial understanding. I think sometimes sports governing bodies can be too beholden to funding and the way the funding's constructed, that you have to spend it a certain way. And actually growing your business and becoming financially independent is down to the amount of money, resource and vision you have for your brand. So what can football learn from other sports? I think sometimes getting a bit closer to the audience. I think we do well generally, but there's still maybe a perceived arrogance that with a national game and fans will turn up and fans will flock and we demand to have back pages. It's funny when you flip and look at other sports who would absolutely love to have the back 10 pages, yet sometimes football kind of loathes the fact that there's so much scrutiny, so much attention. Imagine what it's like for a minority sport trying to find its voice in what is a fairly saturated sports market. So not use size to the detriment of personal conversations. What? That was a bit deep, wasn't it?
You've been a journalist, obviously. You've worked with Scottish FA, now agency side. What makes a good PR media person in football for you?
In football? An all-rounder. But people keep talking about PR or marketeer or content. So the outputs may be slightly different, but the whole thing is around content, and the sooner we all get our heads around that, the better. So what does a good PR in Scottish football look like? Somebody who has ideas, somebody who can put those ideas into practice, somebody who can ideally edit those ideas into practice, somebody who can write those ideas into practice, and somebody who knows a big enough network of people or understands enough around social media to make that content appeal to as many people as possible. An all-rounder. People are coming out 10 a penny with master's degrees in journalism and PR and communications and marketing, and ultimately they will lead themselves into a very similar vein. Understand your subject matter, understand your audience, cater to it. And if you want to know what the audience wants, ask the audience or the various audiences. Don't be scared to make a mistake, but be open-minded and don't be arrogant.
That'd be a bit of practical advice then for clubs, especially, and we've said this a few times, but lower down the pyramid is ask, conduct surveys, or simple thing is Twitter polls.
It's easy saying to a League Two club, ask, do surveys. They might have four staff and their main job is keeping that club afloat because they get 400 fans in. Where I think, and you look at the William Hill Scottish Cup toolkit, for example, there's more help that can be provided, I think, and we do it for national associations with UEFA, but making it easy for people, having a toolkit that doesn't mean you get 55 different iterations of the same campaign, but actually something that allows you, regardless of resource, because you know that the FA or the German FA or the KNVB will have sufficient resource to take what you're getting at and do it in their own way, creatively. But for the tail of organisations or national associations, it's a massive help. You make it easy for people. And the easier you make it, the easier it is to attract the people that you want to come to your game. So toolkits help, I think, taking a lot of the toil out of it. And I think a fear, people see it as this big expensive thing that they can't afford to buy. Yeah. As soon as you see it as a cost, you've lost. If you see it as an investment, it can then grow, and with the social platforms we've talked about, there's an easy way of measuring it.
If you believe everything that you see or read in Scottish football, we're jumping from, at times, one crisis to another. I know, having spoke to you and you've done some training on this, When is a crisis really a crisis?
You want me to read out my time-honoured Alistair Campbell quote? Well, funny you should mention that. The difference between a drama and a crisis, or a bit of media frenzy and a crisis, is that a crisis, he's defined, and who am I to disagree with Malcolm Tucker, a situation that threatens to overwhelm an organisation and requires good decision making. So what we get largely in Scottish football week after week is melodrama. Refereeing mistakes, or that's not a crisis. I think sometimes we're quick to believe what we see in 148 point in the back page of a newspaper, and that's great because it creates a different type of buzz. You just don't have to believe in it, and you, worse than that, you shouldn't shape your policy because of what you read. Too many people fall into the trap of, we're in crisis. Are we in crisis? No, we're not. Yeah, we are. And before you know it, they're in a crisis because they're taking crisis steps, when actually, block it out. A couple of obvious examples of crises that we utilise. If you look at the Alton Towers situation, that was a very bad situation that became an immediate crisis through that infamous Kay Burley interview. But actually, the steps that the organisation took them out of the crisis, and that's became a best practice guideline in crisis comms. BA IT failing became a crisis, not because the system went down for a while, but the panic that was caused by bad decision making by the leadership. United Airlines, bad enough that a passenger gets dragged out of his seat bleeding, but the immediate statement from the chief exec made it worse, made it a global crisis, because rather than apologise to the passenger, can apologise to everybody else for the inconvenience of somebody being battered to a pulp by security. So understanding a crisis, not being swayed from your strategy, will help you avoid one. But that's, Alistair's quite clear on blocking out noise, and a crisis only manifests itself when it has a material impact in the business, and you know when that happens. But you can certainly take a drama and turn it into a crisis pretty quickly.
So, talking football example from recent then, like Granit Xhaka at Arsenal, not a crisis,
no,
just a drama.
Drama, an absolute drama that will resolve itself one of two ways. He will either come back, score a goal, and everything will be forgotten. He'll come out, say he's sorry, manager will say to the fans, lay off him a bit, and it will get resolved, or come January, they'll disappear. All three may happen, but that's not a crisis.
Let's just say there is a crisis of whatever, and I'm sure you've been involved in one or two in your time. What are your sort of recommended actions and first steps, really, to try and dissolve the situation?
Establish if it genuinely is a crisis, and that needs complete understanding and trust with your board, with your chief exec, and to then look at how you first minimise the crisis. So does the crisis threaten the whole of the game? Is it something that needs a cerebral approach to? Does it need clear, proactive communication, or is it something that needs to be contained so that it doesn't spread into a crisis? There's probably a couple of recent examples that are worth looking at, because in many ways they had the hallmarks of a crisis. So child sexual abuse, I know it's not a great subject for a podcast, but Scottish football was faced with a crisis situation, not of its own doing in the here and now, but because of behaviours and what was permitted, frankly, decades ago. So you've got two choices. You either deny it, put your fingers in your ears and hope it goes away when it doesn't, or you take a responsible approach. The responsible approach is independent review. Have that published with recommendations, act on it, get to a situation where you have 5/6 well-being and protection officers who understand in 2019 what is acceptable, to work with the relevant authorities, and more importantly, to give confidence to families and kids that Scottish football is safe in 2019. Not to the detriment of acknowledging what had happened, and to show contrition and to show heartfelt apology to anybody who suffered that kind of abuse. So that's a pertinent example of something that, to the individuals involved, and when you look at it reputationally, a crisis situation. But it's one that you can make worse by completely denying it or taking an irresponsible approach. Dementia. Again, what we know now versus how balls were before and the style of the game, etc., etc. The crisis is doing nothing. The crisis is waiting for that medical report to come out and distancing yourself from it. The responsible approach is to embrace it, to understand that actually we're fortunate in Scotland to have such great NHS records, that fortunate to have two of the experts in the field, and work with them to provide practical solutions that actually show that you have a responsibility as the governing body to the game, and that you can take leadership on it. It doesn't diminish from what had happened previously. It doesn't make any wild assumptions based on that research, but it's a responsible approach to something that, to the families involved, to people who have loved ones who suffer from dementia and who feel vindicated because of this study, you have to show that empathy, you have to be responsible.
What do you see then as common pitfalls, whether it's even a mild drama or you verge into the crisis territory, that clubs, the common pitfalls that they just seem to fall into every time?
Panic, because it's no different to government. We're in the midst of, well, an election campaign now, and there's panic everywhere. We've had 2.5 years of panic on Brexit, and whatever your politics, only we could look at something that might have some merit, take the decision, and then spend the rest of the time trying to unpick it. So that courage of your conviction. Do you trust your manager? Do you trust the strategy that you've deployed because you hired that person? Do you see a way out of this situation? Do you have enough trust in your senior team, in your dressing room, to get you out of it? And invariably, what happens is when the flames start to lick higher up the food chain, people get twitchy. And that's when instability comes. Fans latch onto it. Players understand that this is lame duck territory now. And then you get poor decisions, or decisions that are reactive to fan animosity, and decisions that sometimes go against your own business practice. So as hard as it is, courage your conviction. If you have a plan, stick to it. And if you think that it's going to become a crisis, either in financial terms or to your bottom line, then you have to take a different action. But people fall into the trap of being told they're in a crisis and accepting it. Or worst of all, the old Bill Clinton analogy. Did you have sexual relations with that woman? No, I didn't. I didn't have sex with Monica Lewinsky, said Bill Clinton. Who believed him after that? If he'd have said he was in a happy, loving relationship, time would still have caught up with him, but you don't engage that immediate negative.
Do you think it's worse nowadays with kind of social media in comparison to maybe it was even a couple of years back?
Didn't feel like that in the early days of social media and Rangers liquidation. And I think it's, I don't like it when managers come out and go, ah, oh, it's terrible with social media, or I don't listen to social media. It's just like people say, I don't read the papers or I don't watch. Of course you do. But there has to be a filter. You understand when you go on Twitter or Instagram that a percentage of people who follow you don't want to follow you because they like your content, just like to feel important. So I don't like when I hear people blocking out, or I did that because I get trolled on Twitter. I understand that when there's a mental health issue with people who have gotten so far down that rabbit hole they can't get out, but it's there. You know what to expect with Twitter. You know what to expect when you go on Facebook and start looking through the news feed. So either don't put yourself through, but don't deny it. Have a filter that enables you to live in the real world and embrace the many benefits of social media. No different to society. In fact, it's probably the most accurate reflection on society of any medium.
Yeah. Which is worrying. So, fan pressure is one, and we're seeing managers lose their jobs because of fan pressure.
Well, they lose jobs, A, because of results. Results feed lack of confidence, oblique learned helplessness in players, which then annoys fans, who are the paying customer, who don't want to take it out on the players, so either take it out on the manager, and if they don't get enough joy or results don't turn, then start to focus the other way. And it's always been that way, whether it was in the days where print ruled the roost, or even probably pre-national media, and it's always going to be the case. But across the world, we're watching people who resign because of varying degrees of crisis or melodrama. If you're in charge of that organisation, you've got a responsibility to do right by it. If you're a public company, you've got a responsibility to shareholders. If you're a football club, you've got a responsibility to your club and your fans. So sometimes the tougher decision is actually blocking it out, unless you're genuinely in crisis and you go through the steps to diagnose it as a crisis, in which case you have to act.
Fascinating. I think we could probably listen to that all night as well, but
I'm sure the listeners wouldn't.
Yeah, they might do. Hopefully they'll listen to it from this point.
Hopefully, but, that's a watering down word. That's a terrible word. Ban that.
Finish us up. I wanted to ask, we probably touched on it a little bit earlier as well, but what is the future of PR marketing in Scottish football?
Whatever we want it to be. whatever we can continue to push for, to understand. You can look to America and we can all come up with great examples. I just gave you a Canadian basketball. We know where the market is. We know how other sports with infinite budgets succeed. But we can do it. We have been doing it on a smaller budget. I think, and I say it again, embrace younger people full of enthusiasm. Embrace the geeks. And I don't say that in a disparaging way, but in football, there's the kind of the football type and the football person you must kind of adhere to when we're recruiting. Just understand how society's axis spins now and embrace it. We're no different to the tech companies I'd mentioned. We can be an Airbnb, we can be an Uber. We just have to embrace that football is now propped up by the same mechanisms because that's what youngsters want. The whole 90-minute football live experience, anathema to a 12-year-old kid. So let's not try and sell them something they don't want, because that's a surefire way of 20 years down the line having no fans. Embrace it, make it simple, and understand you don't have all the answers. Hire people better than you.
And then taking that then, and you've worked in newspapers, and this is not a beating newspapers up, but what is the future of newspapers and news consumption?
Paper generally. I get twitchy about the amount of paper that creatives leave on the desk because they need to do scamps. It's how we consume it. I find it heartbreaking because one of my favourite things in life was sitting reading the Sunday Times in Epicures in the West End. And I read the Sunday Times on my app. That's just it. My habits have changed. So that's where it is. So future of newspapers is understanding how to maximise your advertising, how to get yourself a website that is actually attractive to people, because you can't say we're dialing down on the newsprint, which is great and everybody should do it, but not when your online offering is so bad an experience that you would rather actually just sit and stare at the wall for a bit. Understanding when sign-ups can unlock data but not be a barrier to entry. Stop giving me the pop-up because I just want to see that article, and maybe over time then I'll think about subscribing. Understanding not only your current audience, understanding the future audience. Because if you don't understand the future audience or deploy enough human resource or data-driven insight to the people who are not on your platform, you ain't going to grow. You're only going to get smaller because people die. What a cheery way to end the conversation. People die.
Well, I'm going to say, like, obviously you've got models now like The Athletic.
Yep.
Do you see more of that sort of paid for content across sport in general, or is it always going to be because there's enough free people are going to do something for free that you'll be able to get that?
Best idea wins. Couple of OTT platforms coming, everybody wants an OTT platform, the same way that 20 years ago everybody wanted a website. Scottish FA was the first national association to have a website. Did we know that? There we go.
Probably kept the same one for 15 years after though.
Well, I've still got painful memories of that CMS. At least you've changed that. So people will continue to experiment, and it's great that the market has been disrupted because different people want different things. Podcasts. Sitting on a podcast, 2 years ago the podcast was a bit of a curiosity. Now everybody wants to rush to get a podcast. Then you hear the naysayers going, ah, a podcast, there you go. If it's worth listening to, people will listen. If it's niche enough not to worry about being saturated by big beasts, then fine. If we want to get together at 7 o'clock at night in a darkened room and chat sports market, people will listen to it because there's an audience, and an audience who actually want to go and help our sport domestically thrive. Did that answer, what was the question again? Turned into Gordon Strachan.
It was more around the future ways of going to consume. So I talked about The Athletic, paid-for models, for example.
Athletic's a fascinating insight because spending massively on the best talent across the UK, very good reads. The challenge is the people that they've hired, have they hired them because people want to read them, or will they now gravitate back to Guardian or Times because they've just replaced that person? It's an interesting thing. We had it, I remember in the kind of latter days of the Herald, there was an actual conversation on, if you leave the Herald, you're going to have to leave your social media because we've effectively helped you get that. Mad argument. But it's the same thing. Will people go to The Athletic because of the standard of journalism by the individual, or is the paywall or the four free articles a sufficient barrier of entry for people who have been wedded to the Guardian model versus the Daily Mail model versus the Times. If they get enough people to answer that question for them versus what they're paying to get the best sports writers and sports journalism, more power to them. If they don't, the guarantee is someone will be hot on the horizon trying something very similar, and it might just be a case of timing.
I'm intrigued to see what happens with Athletic year two once, because I paid the half price subscription or whatever it was.
Cheapskate.
Yeah, well, I've got to pay for something.
My wife's still technically a student, so it's been great.
But how, when they come back next year to me going, actually, I want double what you paid originally for this product. Now, don't get me wrong, I like The Athletic, I think it's really good. Would I pay 50 quid for it? No chance.
But then you're into the personalisation, because you might, if you feel strongly about that and happy to take a month off your TV subscription, or if you've got a Netflix subscription or Amazon. So individuals all have different tastes. I mean, when you talk about the future of football or the future of Scottish football, you could conceivably, and it's not within the realms of possibility, that you've got an Amazon season ticket to go to whatever games you want, or spliced however you want, and your journey delivered by Uber. With people listening to this going, what planet are they on? But that's where the market is. Something akin to that's going to happen. It's just who's going to take that idea first, who's going to run with it, and how does that help a particular league or club thrive?
I was going to ask, Michael obviously asked about kind of newspapers and news consumption in general, but then flipping that back to Scottish football clubs and maybe even football clubs in general, how do they then work with newspapers and news consumption in general? How does that relationship work?
It's an essential part of the mix. Newspapers are still widely read. Newspapers still have a high proportion of advertising revenue. They can't be mutually exclusive. My own point of view, I spend most of my time on a weekly basis speaking to news media, traditional journalists, online journalists, vloggers, fan influencers, marketeers. And my role, I see, is effectively like a central midfielder, trying to make sure that everybody understands, because of the disruption, the various disciplines have kind of fragmented. And I think, without going back to advertising mode, but the kind of beauty of a frame type model is you understand how you can be that central piece bringing it all together. That way you don't have to go there for your marketing, go there for your advertising, go there because he or she knows that journalist. It's actually understanding how you can keep all the parts moving and show that value, show that return on investment for everybody. So newspapers remain an essential part of the mix, and I keep saying it in my media training, and it's maybe becoming less and less so, but I still maintain that the value of a back page headline can still do for a sporting figure than online. The balance is probably starting to tip now, but don't underestimate the importance of traditional news journalism. And let's, I'm loath to have people say, oh, journalism, and again, in the same way that print journalists and newspapers are absolutely beholden to what happens online, yet there's almost this snobbery on both sides that the traditional mainstream media and all these online bampots, and I still get reminded of a really ill-advised column from years ago when I referred to internet bampots. So if nothing else, it shows I've moved with the times to understand that both sides need to coexist, and there might be a reluctance to accept it, but one feeds the other. And the more people who are talking about football, for good, for bad, I'd rather people were talking about us than not talking about us.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm putting you in charge of Scottish football for one day, and you can only change one thing. What is it?
The dress code.
Oh, no blazers.
Well, I banned the blazers, actually, if we've got time for that. The first thing I did when I saw George Peel, said, even burn them outside, but actually move away from blazers, and we got Hugo Boss suits. Made not a jot of difference. So I think that the point I'm making is the stuffiness. We're a relaxed, smart, casual society now, so let's embrace it. Really trivial, but I think it sets the tone for how everything else is done as an organisation and within football.
And that's across clubs?
Everywhere.
I think there is an element of its culture, really.
I could see something like take away the halfway line. 12 a side.
Multiple.
Can't he do it? But actually, it's more a philosophical, let's just chill out, let's relax a bit.
Creating a different culture and environment. And I think it does. It encourages more creativity as well, where you can come up with a lot of the solutions that does do. And I'm not saying because you wear a suit to work, you can't come up with creative ideas, but as you said, perception's a big thing about it as well.
Daryl, thanks very much. I mean, that was a whirlwind where we stopped on a few different stops. Aye. There, but a lot to take away from.
Yeah, definitely.
What clubs can do, how they look at things, I think, more than anything. And as you said, especially around the crisis PR, it's not always a crisis. It's just let the dust settle and move on. Before we finish up, and feel free to jump in at any point, you've already had a couple of good examples.
Sure, you've got more.
Oh,
Chris, what have you seen recently that you want to call out?
Definitely. So first one, obviously Aberdeen opened their new training complex this week, which I think, if we're talking content, opens up a few new avenues for them. But one of the things I noticed from this weekend, we're recording after Aberdeen have won 3-0 against Killy. It was our Junior Dons Day. So they had young fans kind of filling roles of mini match announcer or mini media assistant, even mini manager as well. And it was kind of all under 12 season ticket holders or Aber DNA members that had the chance to apply for that as well. So that kind of ties in with what we talked about to Scott before.
Yeah, it also ties in with, it must have been a weekend for junior takeovers because Swindon Town did the exact same down south. And I know we had mentioned them before and they seem to be doing a lot more in the fan engagement.
Yeah, definitely. My other one, I know we're aiming the podcast at all kind of levels, but I think Rangers video content this season is kind of the level that all clubs in Scotland should probably be aspiring to. I think they're kind of smashing it with the approach as well this so far this season. So they give kind of just the right amount of free stuff and then kind of push people towards Rangers TV as well, which I think is a really good approach to take.
Can't look beyond, well, it's boxing, is it UFC? The rematch, KSI Logan Paul. If nothing else, it shows, regardless of how rubbish the event is, if you promote it properly,
yeah,
people will go. So that might be an odd one to leave on, but it just shows that with the right willingness, with the right idea, you can sell anything.
Oh, definitely. And I think, well, you look at that, they've actually got world title fights on the undercard to two YouTubers fighting. But smart and away from boxing, where yes, you're upsetting a bit of the core audience, but you're also attracting all these new potential fans. And not everybody's going to turn into a fan, but more aware of boxing, more exposed to what is going on,
the and kind of the setup of it.
Yeah, and partners. And
I'm going to give another boxing example quickly if we've got time. Yeah. Josh Taylor, one of our most successful sports people in the here and now, world champion. An eye that wouldn't be out of place in a Halloween movie. No problem speaking to the media. No problem inviting the Sky cameras in the morning after. He now understands the value in that achievement. Speak directly to the audience and not put up barriers. A very coarse example of a different sport where they embrace communication. Understand the audience. There's an Edinburgh fighter who's now down in London because that's where his training is, and it'll be an interesting journey to remain Scottish, and he's already out talking about Edinburgh Castle, and of course a spokesperson from the castle said, oh, we don't know about boxing. But it'll be an interesting journey for him to be seen as Scotland's champion, not just Josh Taylor from Edinburgh, on a global scale. But he's taken the first steps by being amenable, working on his public profile, and it'll be a fascinating journey for him.
Yeah, very much looking forward. And just for the record, we got him in early for a Scottish Cup draw. So, Josh, you're more than welcome back. Yeah, I've got a couple of quick ones. Also, funny enough, a Rangers one. And just today, I noticed that before we started recording, they launched their Fit Bears app, which is trying to drive health benefits in their fans. But their app is going to be monitor your movements, walking, steps, etc. But also compete against fellow fans, give that sort of gamification and the general basis of helping fans get healthier, but also give you Rangers news, competitions. And what I've looked at and put on my geek hat, if you like, is they're getting some amount of data now. If you're looking at, do I understand how active fans are, all the personal information that goes with that. So yeah, look, great to see one encouraging more activity within football fans and being healthier, and but clever in terms of another way to push out more Rangers messaging, but then also all that data.
Societal benefit as well. You have government targets for health provision, and you show that you can actually not just make a sporting difference to fans week after week, but actually make them healthier, make them live longer. Got it made, and probably something that's derived out of the SPFL's football fans and training, which has been world leading.
Yeah, and you look at the SROI, the Social Return on Investment report that Danny Bisland, who's on a previous podcast, spoke about, and the health benefits of Scottish football just by playing it does, let alone everything else that goes with it. My final example, just to wrap up, was one from the States, and it was the Washington Nationals, who went on to win the World Series while they were participating. They've got a partner.
The president got a good reception there, didn't they?
Just like he did at the UFC. Obviously, the American medical system is very, very different and probably topical in a different type of podcast. But one of their partners is this healthcare provision, and in their local hospital, they kitted out every newborn baby on a certain day in Washington Nationals gear, and there was a goodie bag in each of the things. Now, clever in a number of different ways. One, of course, is pretty much the major baseball team for that city, so it's a one team city, if you like, which there's plenty of examples in Scotland. Two, tapped into a young audience at the very first day they can get them, but also the parents and that sort of feel good PR factor around that. And second of all, it was a partner they did it with as well, so they also activated on a brand and a partnership deal there. So I thought it worked on different levels, and it was just, there's some great content and imagery out there of just all these lines of newborn babies just in Washington National.
Perfect. Daryl, thank you very much again for coming on.
Excellent, not a problem. Good to see that in one podcast we covered both life and death in the space of 45 minutes.
Wonderful. Politics in between.
Absolutely.